Many people in many parts of the world are looking for something simple. They're looking for a life that has simple answers. And they see it, or they're convinced they can see it, in authoritarianism. And so many parts of the world are turning to that form of government. It's a sad moment. For the adoption of authoritarianism means an end to dealing with the climate crisis. It's simply not on their agenda. The other thing that disappears under authoritarianism is democracy. And if we ever needed democracy, it's as we work on solving the climate crisis. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Next, we have a piece from the newsroom in New Zealand. It's not really about the climate crisis. It's about the lack of trust in the media and the lack of trust in democracy. Let's have a listen now to that audio.
Kia ora, I'm Mark Jennings, and today on The Detail, trust in the media is on the slide, both here and overseas.
You can feel it fraying. You can feel the influences of the polarisation, for example, out of the US, which plays in everybody's media and how that's putting new pressures on as well.
Last year's AUT Trust in News survey found that just 45% of us were prepared to say we trust the news most of the time. And in this year's survey, fresh out this week, it's fallen again to just 42%.
Although the BBC is the most fantastic public institution, it's really important that the public maintains its trust in it. And what we've heard from audiences is that some people think it's biased.
Here in New Zealand, the problem has not been helped by politicians who attack reporters and interviewers who dare to ask the tough questions. And during the election campaign, threats from politicians were coming thick and fast.
Democracy is about hearing both sides of the story, not hearing arrogant, jumped up, overpaid people think they know more about this country.
Mr. Peters, you have
thank
railed against co-governance.
Thank you, Jack. You just made a hopeless case here.
You've railed against co-governance.
For us to make sure we get the broadcasting portfolio after this election.
Is that a threat, Mr. Peters?
If you keep doing negative interviews like this, you won't help, Jack.
Politicians and journalists have always had a combative relationship. As a young journalist, I remember being laid into by the fearsome Robert Muldoon, a national prime minister who had a particular dislike for reporters and their pesky questions.
Prime Minister, it's customary in an interview for the interviewer to ask questions
yes,
and for them to be answered singly.
I'm not much interested in what's customary.
But things have got worse, much worse. Blaming the media for everything is now a national pastime. In my 22 years as head of TV3 News and 7 years as co-editor of Newsroom, I've seen the public trust in the media decline to a point where it's impacting our democracy. Victoria University's communications lecturer Peter Thompson has spent most of his working life observing the media, and he agrees.
This is one of the reasons why I think it's so dangerous if people in significant positions of responsibility, such as government ministers, perpetuate these myths that somehow that none of the media can be trusted at all. I mean, that engenders a deep kind of cynicism that's harmful and corrosive to all forms of democratic politics.
A new low appeared to be reached at the end of last year.
A new government was sworn in today, but the old Winston Peters turned up, accusing the outgoing government of bribing the media.
You cannot defend $55 million of bribery. Get it very clear.
That $55 million refers to the now-finished Public Interest Journalism Fund, a pot of money Labor set aside to strengthen journalism. It funded The Detail, for example. Perhaps worse than Peters' remarks, though, was the casual response from other MPs who failed to call him out.
Has Winston Peters been truthful and accurate in his claim that the government has bribed media?
Look, I think that Winston's being Winston. He's not the only politician in Parliament who's been critical of the media. That's just something that's par for the course, really.
The reality is he was expressing the views that a lot of people think, actually, which is that the Public Interest Journalism Fund didn't work that well, actually.
But it's a lie. That's a lie, Chris. Mm. And that is the job of you as the government to clear up, because otherwise it just plays into that perception and adds fuel to the fire. You cannot have the Deputy Prime Minister just echoing the ramblings of some conspiratorial lunatics on Twitter.
Newsroom's political editor Joe Moyer says ACT leader David Seymour did call Peters out in a blunt statement, saying the bribery allegation didn't pass the sniff test.
He was basically saying that what Winston Peters was suggesting wasn't true. Now, Christopher Luxon and Chris Bishop could have also made those comments and could have differentiated between not agreeing with the policy but also saying, well, obviously this isn't what was happening and journalists weren't being bribed. Especially when you take into consideration that $55 million was actually not able to be used for political journalism. So when Winston Peters talks about the political journalists in the press gallery having been bribed, it is nonsensical. But no, they didn't. The National Prime Minister and Senior Minister decided that they would, I guess, not wholeheartedly agree with what Winston Peters was saying, but definitely muddied it a little bit by not being clearer about the fact that they didn't believe that journalists were being bribed, and just left it open to interpretation and talked about this public perception, which is, you know, a bit of an uncomfortable space to leave it in when it's pretty well known and established that that is not the case.
I think, Joe, there were 92,000 pieces of content produced under the PIJF, and not one complaint of media bias was upheld. So it is baseless. Why do you think Lux and Bishop were not straighter about this?
Well, I probably would say that they had the cover of that public perception. I mean, this has been a big issue. You only need to spend 2 minutes on social media, in particular Twitter, now known as X, which, you know, don't necessarily recommend anyone spend 2 minutes on there at the best of times. But this is a really, really common theme. And I think what you saw with National is that very early on and still now even, and I think this will continue throughout the 3 years of this term, there is a little bit of walking on eggs. There's a little bit of being mindful of their coalition partner, New Zealand First, and Winston Peters, and the positions he takes on things, and wanting to not sort of say, well, he's outright incorrect. However, I think David Seymour probably did a pretty good job of doing that without necessarily being offensive to Winston Peters in the process. But yes, National probably in that situation felt like they had some cover with the fact that a large chunk of the population simply does not understand how that Public Interest Journalism Fund was actually operating. There is a lot of misinformation out there about it. And unfortunately, rather than taking an opportunity to clear that up, it's just kind of fed in more to that public perception.
Former MP Peter Dunn told our producer Alexia Russell he was surprised there wasn't a stronger reaction from Peter's colleagues.
My initial reaction was like probably most other politicians, and that is, oh, well, that's just Winston. But when you think about it, it was a much more sinister attack than just some cavalier lines thrown around. This was an attempt to intimidate, to set an agenda that was clearly that we're in charge now and that you people aren't going to tell us what to do and what to say. And I think that if you take the politics out of it, I think that there was a call for a stronger response from some politicians. I'm a little bit surprised that there wasn't. I suspect their view was, well, if you just sort of shut up about it, it'll all go away. The problem is, what it does is, if it's not challenged, is it creates an impression in people's minds that there might be some substance in what's being said, and I think that then tarnishes all future perceptions of comments by politicians and media, and I just don't think it's helpful. It was unfortunate.
If it doesn't go away and it festers.
Yeah, I think it does fester. I mean, there will always be people who will believe that there's a giant conspiracy out there, that the media aren't credible, that the media are biased, all of those sorts of things. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't elements of truth in those allegations, but there will be people who will just feed on that, and the fact that there was no strong challenge to them will reinforce in their minds that actually he's right. And I think that that's not healthy for our democracy. There needs to be challenge, there needs to be debate, And there needs to be response when things are said that people aren't happy with.
Once someone in a position of power like this has made such accusations and they have been left to lie, is that a box that you can't shut the lid on that box anymore?
It depends what happens next. I noticed that he hasn't really sort of done much by way of repeating the line. I think that was because the whole plan was to get on top right from the beginning, put everyone on the back foot by making comments that were totally unexpected and wildly inaccurate. The fact they've gone unchallenged in some people's mind will mean they've gone away, but I suspect for a lot of other people they'll still be there lingering and will pop up at some point in the future. And these things never go away, unfortunately.
And Peter Thompson says trying to correct that lie now is almost impossible.
Trying to engage people and correct disinformation in this current environment is proving really difficult. Once people seem to get it fixed in their minds, you know, that the media are all biased or mainstream media is just all run by elites and it's against their interests, no amount of rational information or persuasion, you know, seems to get them to budge from that position. And by simply validating public misperceptions, you're not correcting the issue. And I think that the problem here is that those misperceptions then start to translate into the sorts of policies that governments think are viable.
Peter, you've spent most of your working life studying and watching the media. Why have we ended up with such low levels of trust and declining levels of trust in the media?
I think there's always been a certain degree of scepticism about media of all varieties. I think what we're seeing more of now is a deep-seated cynicism towards any kind of media, and particularly so-called mainstream media. And I think that's been exacerbated by the huge quantities of disinformation, or at least dubious information, that circulates through social media.
Most people would agree that mainstream media has and does play a really important role in the health of our democracy. Yet we see some of the most important figures in democracy, politicians, constantly attacking the media. How corrosive is this?
I certainly think it's corrosive. I think it's quite problematic that politicians often try and score points on issues related to media by, you know, attacking the opposition's policy. Often these are cheap shots. They're not always well thought out. I thought it was quite instructive that just this last week, Lucy Fraser, you know, the culture secretary in the UK, was called to account on Sky News for saying that she thought the BBC was biased, and when she was asked for examples, really couldn't give one. So I think there's a tendency for politicians to engage in point-scoring discourses, you know, where they think that a cheap shot at the media that will appeal to their supporters is going to gain them some sort of political advantage. And often these aren't well thought through arguments. And I think part of the problem here is this very complex symbiotic relationship that we see between, you know, the media and the sphere of politics. You know, politicians need the media, media need the politicians, but in the middle, particularly where there's such intense competition for eyeballs and advertising, we see the space for serious debate being corroded. And that's been going on a long time, but it's got a lot worse over the last 15, 20 years.
Do you think the failing model, the failing economic model of the mainstream media is one of the root causes of this?
I think it is. And the reason I would say that is that when you set up a media operation primarily to deliver eyeballs to advertisers or to maximise online traffic, you obviously have an eye on the content being attractive and being able to sustain an audience. And, of course, that's a good thing, generally speaking, for all media, you know, including non-commercial media. However, it becomes corrosive when even small margins start driving serious decisions about editorial priorities in the newsroom. And what we're seeing, I think, is this shift towards a kind of a populist approach to news, where anything that's in-depth, serious, or likely to disenchant an audience and get them to switch over is going to be regarded as commercially risky. And once everything is dictated through a lens of commercial risk and optimizing eyeballs and revenue, the scope of genres that are viable economically get narrowed down. And I think that's part of the problem. I mean, the classic example is, if you go and turn on the 6 o'clock news, how long does a politician have to explain a policy, before their soundbite gets cut? I've done that myself, and I think you're lucky if you get 10 seconds these days.
I think the relationship between, and I would talk just from the perspective of the press gallery and politicians, is still very much a we need each other relationship. It's always been like that. And, politicians are well aware that they rely on the press gallery in terms of getting out stories that they want promoted and want out there, whether it's from an opposition perspective or a government perspective. But also know that, if they stuff up or something goes wrong, that obviously they'll be held to account on that as well. I don't think that relationship has changed at all. I think, there's always been that sort of, I guess, respectful understanding that both politicians and political journalists have a job to do. And that hasn't, I wouldn't describe that as having become more corrosive. Some particular politicians may be more frank about their feelings about journalists, for example, but I wouldn't say it's across the board, no.
Well, why do you think Winston is so... I mean, one of the things in his broadcasting policy that was put out there prior to the election, he wanted a royal commission into media bias. Why is he the flag bearer for this?
I think this probably comes back to COVID. I think the public perception around particularly the press gallery, given we were the ones in the room at 1 o'clock every day during the pandemic, and all of a sudden a press conference in the Beehive Theatreette that basically nobody used to watch became like regular primetime television for people, and all of a sudden the public became very engaged in what the press gallery journalists were asking of politicians. And you have seen that play out in the way that the public, I think, over the last few years has become increasingly more critical, I guess, of journalists, in particular political journalists. And again, I just point back to social media and just sort of general commentary and things people actually say to your face in the street as well. Generally, that perception and that sort of trust and that sort of like, I guess, has declined as a result of them kind of seeing us do our jobs in real, sort of lifetime. And the idea behind those press conferences is not necessarily for it to be public viewing like that, because those press conferences aren't the story. They are just part of the mechanism for writing a story or putting a story to TV. And there's all these other sort of bits that happen in the background, which I guess the public don't see. So I guess to cut a long story short, the public now have this kind of different perspective, I guess, on the way that journalists do their job. And I think Winston Peters has seen an opportunity with that. He was out of Parliament for 3 years. He's always had this interesting balance between being quite a defender of journalists sometimes, while on the other hand also having a really on-again, off-again relationship with them. I'm always amused when I think back to, quite a few years ago now at Waitangi, where we were being told that we had to pay like something ridiculous, like $10,000 in order to go on to Te Marae to film it. And Winston Peters announced that he wasn't going to go on to Te Marae because the journalists weren't allowed to go on, which seemed kind of bizarre at the time because he's never been the big defender of journalists. But, he did actually kind of at times have our back, and that's changed, I just think.
Here's Peter Thompson again.
How you persuade a politician like that, that actually the world isn't entirely against them, I'm not quite sure.
He says there's quite a trend from politicians, not just in New Zealand, to use the rhetoric of public perception to say there's an issue that must be dealt with.
One of the issues that I think we have to be very careful about is that that plays into this idea that public perceptions are always valid. And I think sometimes you have to call public perceptions out and correct them. And I think the some of the discourse around the Public Interest Journalism Fund, that it was all some sort of Māori conspiracy, that all the news had to reflect a particular editorial slant on Te Tiriti. And if you look at it closely, as I've done in a recent conversation piece, that wasn't the case at all. I mean, I can understand why there might have been a perception there that all the news had to be respectful of the treaty, but that still allowed for a wide variety of opinions. And by simply validating public misperceptions, you're not correcting the issue. And I think that the problem here is that those misperceptions then start to translate into the sorts of policies that governments think are viable. And there's actually some evidence of this. When the previous Labour government formulated its Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, some of the cabinet papers actually revealed that they'd considered a number of alternative options but discounted them, partly because of concerns that the public perceived publicly funded media as potentially, biased. And that simply isn't correct. But rather than actually make the effort to correct public understanding, there was almost an acquiescence to the disinformation. And I think that's terribly dangerous.
Perception, when it comes to trust, is just as important as the reality, is it not?
No, sometimes perception is completely wrong.
I'm not asking if it's right or wrong, but I'm saying it's just as important. When it comes to an issue of trust, perception is just as important as the reality. So whether
or not...
I'm
not sure if I agree with you on that, Jack.
Okay, so...
Because there's a lot of perceptions that people have...
So you're not concerned that many people would look at, say, this show, for example, and say, that received money from the Public Interest Journalism Fund. I don't trust that show anymore.
Yeah, no, I am concerned about that, because we have we've got that type of complaint. Doesn't matter what we say, it doesn't matter the history we give in terms of funding shows like this. There's one view of this is about, well, Willie Jackson paying off Jack Tame. I get that. Yeah. I get that. But you're never going to change some of those perceptions.
There's a very complex relationship between the media and the government and the funding bodies. Once you've got a source of funding, I think it's fair to say that you tend to be a little bit protective of that. I don't know why there wasn't a stronger pushback on the PIJF criticism from people who, for whatever reason, perceived it to be an example of the government trying to control the media agenda. And that simply wasn't the case at all. Most people that understand the media would never say such a thing. But if enough voices online start to snipe at a particular policy or a particular funding model, some of the mud sticks. And I don't know what we do about trying to get that mud off off public perceptions. It certainly is a problem.
There has been quite a lot of talk and discussion in the media, particularly amongst senior editorial people, about whether we should even report Winston Peters' attacks on the media. When he says there's corruption and clearly there's no basis for that, whether we should all just stick together and decide not to report him. What do you think of that idea?
If I was a news editor, I think I'd find that very tempting. However, I think that also might play into Mr. Peters' hands, or at least his perceptions, that the media were conspiring against him.
Now we shift to a story from the New York Times, and again, it's not directly about the climate crisis, but it's about democracy, and the two are interrelated. The story is by Michelle Goldberg. It has the headline, "In Poland, I saw what a second Trump term could do to America." The story begins. Adam Bodnar, Poland's new justice minister, recently explained to me the immense challenge of rebuilding liberal democracy in his country after an eight-year slide towards authoritarianism. Imagine, he said, that Donald Trump had won the last election and had been in power for two terms instead of one. What would be the damage, he asked. After only 4 years of Trump, President Biden inherited a furiously divided nation, its courts seated with right-wing apparatchiks, and the nature of reality itself in deep dispute. But even MGA, that's Make America Great Again, diehards will acknowledge, Trump often failed to bend the state to his will, which is why his allies have a plan to do things differently next time, purging civil servants and replacing them with loyalists. Poland is a country that has gone through something like what Trump has hoped to impose on us in the second term. Its institutions have been hollowed out. Many experienced technocrats and neutral judges have been replaced by lackeys and ideologues. You'll find the link for that story in the show notes. Join me now as we listen to climate specialist from Agriculture Victoria, Graham Anderson, talk about the podcast AgVic Talk.
Welcome to AgVic Talk, keeping you up to date with information from Agriculture Victoria.
Hello and welcome. Graham Anderson here, climate specialist at Agriculture Victoria. I'm very excited to present to you Season 3 of the AgVic Talk podcast, the virtual climate bus tour, taking you to visit farms and advisors who are producing solutions for their regions and businesses in a variable and changing climate. Victoria's farmers know all about seasonal variability. However, our agricultural productivity is being challenged by climate change. The state's average temperatures and the frequency of extreme hot days are increasing, while seasonal rainfall patterns are changing and many are noticing an increase in variable or extreme weather. However, successful agriculture occurs across many climate zones, and in this series, we will hear from farmers looking to other districts for approaches that can work successfully in warmer, drier, or just more variable conditions, and how their farm systems can be adapted with solutions such as stock containment, water, fodder, and infrastructure innovations that have helped manage more extreme weather and seasons. It's all about making the most of the good years and limiting risks in the tough ones. It doesn't matter where you live or what you farm, there will be something in this season for you. For more episodes, find us and follow wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear your feedback, so please leave a comment or rating and share this series with your friends and family.
And now we have two 90-second segments from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Worsening storms, wildfires, and other extreme weather are causing a growing risk of power outages in rural northern New Mexico.
A couple years ago, we had winds over 100 miles an hour in the mountains. Besides taking down a lot of our power lines, just ravaged the forest by taking a lot of trees down.
Luis A. Reyes Jr. is the CEO of Kit Carson Electric Cooperative, which provides power to about 30,000 households in the region. This past fall, the member-owned utility was awarded more than $15 million in funding from the federal bipartisan infrastructure law. Kit Carson will use it to help develop three microgrids, solar and battery installations that can operate independently of the larger grid.
And so if the power goes out because of extreme weather, because of wildfire proximity, where we have to de-energize power lines, now more of the population has electricity through storage.
The systems will be installed in the village of El Rito, near a community college, and an indigenous community called Picariz Pueblo, and at Taos Ski Valley, a village in the mountains. Reyes says that Kit Carson demonstrates how utilities can help build a more resilient energy system as extreme weather grows more common. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org. Technology has come a long way since dial-up internet first allowed people to get online. Today, most U.S. residents have access to high-speed internet, but some rural residents are being left behind.
The best way to characterize broadband access in rural regions is that it's spotty. There's areas that have very good access and others that have almost none.
Mark Kelke is with the West Central Initiative, a community foundation that serves nine counties in West Central Minnesota. His group advocates for better access to broadband internet in the region. He says broadband could benefit people and the climate. That's because rural residents often commute a long distance to go to work, visit the doctor, or spend time with friends. And all that driving emits carbon pollution.
Our region, because of the distances between communities and services, we have a very high vehicle miles traveled rate.
With reliable high-speed internet, more residents could take advantage of telehealth appointments and remote work opportunities. So Kelke says improving access to broadband internet in rural areas could help reduce carbon pollution from vehicles and improve people's quality of life. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Join me now as we shift to a story from The Guardian. It's by Oliver Millman and Dana Noor. It has the headline, in a word, horrific, Trump's extreme anti-environment blueprint. The story begins, the United States' first major climate legislation dismantled, a crackdown on government scientists, a frenzy of oil and gas drilling, the Paris deal not only dead but buried. A blueprint is emerging for a second Donald Trump term that is even more extreme for the environment than his first, according to interviews with multiple Trump allies and advisers. In contrast to a sometimes chaotic first White House term, they outlined a far more methodical second presidency, driving forward fossil fuel production, sidelining mainstream climate scientists, overturning rules that curb planet heating emissions. Trump will undo everything Biden has done. He will move more quickly and go further than he did before, said Myron Ebel, who headed the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, transition term for Trump's first term. Later today, I'm heading to Chitura, a small town about 18 kilometres west of Shepparton, to listen to Andrew Skiok talk about his new book, Deep Listening to Nature. Now, Andrew, I'm told, or he told me himself, has many views about climate change. My plan is to interview Andrew and find out something about the book and also how he feels about climate change and what impact it's having on nature. But in the meantime, I urge you to check out the book, Deep Listening to Nature, by Andrew Skiok. We've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, I'd love some feedback from you, so please let me know what you think. Good or bad, don't hold back. And you can contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Now, feedback, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, so I'll put links to as many as I can in the show notes. So please go there, check them out, read them, make some decisions, and think deeply about how we combat the climate crisis. And beyond that, please share this with your friends. Yes, we all need to know all we possibly can about the climate crisis. Who's saying what? Who's doing what? Who's not saying what they should say? And where we're headed. So please share it. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now stay safe and take care.